Hello and welcome to Secrets of the CIA. My name's Danny Wallace, and over the next 2 hours, I'll be revealing the dodgy, the disastrous, and the scandalous stories from the case files of the Central Intelligence Agency. These are the secrets of the CIA. Now, 60 years ago, the CIA didn't exist, but today it's one of the most powerful organizations in the world. With an estimated $5 billion budget and 25,000 people working for it, the CIA has more money and power than most developing countries. But that immense power has often been used to cause immense screw-ups. Today it's all about the flights of suspects to secret prisons in Europe. But over the years, the CIA has done much worse. At times, it's supported Augusto Pinochet and Saddam Hussein. It's destabilized governments and countries, supported genocidal regimes, and turned a blind eye to drug trafficking. All to follow its goal of protecting American interests.
Thank you. God bless you. And good night.
Of course, conspiracy theorists blame the CIA for everything from assassinating JFK to faking the moon landings.
But we're going to ignore the fiction and concentrate on the facts for the next 2 hours as we dust down the files of the CIA's biggest and most secret operations and reveal the secrets of the CIA. In 1947, as the dust of the Second World War was still settling on an exhausted Europe, the newly formed CIA was fighting the first secret battle of the Cold War. Hitler and the Nazis had been defeated, and now the uneasy truce between the USA and the Soviets had dissolved into a fog of paranoia, secrecy, and intrigue. The CIA's first enemy was to be the Red Menace from Russia.
Our homes, our nation, all the things we believe in are in great danger. This danger has been created by the rulers of the Soviet Union.
In 1946, the CIA was desperate for information and intelligence on the Soviets. It was prepared to employ anyone with insider knowledge on the Russians, even if that meant working with the Nazis.
I was in Austria in the 1940s, and we were under tremendous pressure from our superiors to get information about the Soviet zone of Austria and about Soviet troop movements and Soviet political movements in Hungary and Czechoslovakia. And we had nobody. We had nobody, and so we went and recruited people, and we didn't look very closely, there's no doubt about it, we didn't look very closely about to the background of these people.
Many of these people were hardcore Nazis. Some were out-and-out Nazi war criminals who should have been tried, and many got away with murder.
Using Nazi war criminals is how the CIA got started, and these were as bad guys as you could ever find.
The CIA's main Nazi spy asset was a man by the name of Reinhard Gehlen, seen here in secret footage with other Nazis employed by the CIA. Gehlen had been Hitler's main spy chief against the Russians during the Second World War, so he had massive amounts of intelligence on the Soviets. The CIA thought he'd be the perfect man to do their spying for them.
Reinhard Gehlen was a brigadier general in charge of intelligence on the Eastern Front until April of 1945. April 1945, a month before the war ended, he realized it was lost, and he and several colleagues decided that they would take their files and bury them and give them to the Americans. They felt that they could make a better deal with the Americans, and the CIA, a newly established organization with a good big budget, picked him up.
The CIA brought hundreds of Hitler's ex-intelligence officers back to the USA after the war. At secret bases, they were retrained as CIA spies, then sent back to Germany to start spying on the Russians. So just how many Nazis were on the CIA payroll? Ex-Congresswoman Elizabeth Holtzman has spent years uncovering the CIA's secret Nazi files.
We've discovered already 100 names of Nazi war criminals who were working in Gehlen's operation. They themselves may have been in danger of prosecutions because of their involvement in war crimes. Of course, if they were working for the CIA, that danger was gone.
The CIA did a secret deal with the Nazis. In return for their services, the CIA guaranteed that not one of them would be charged with war crimes committed whilst they'd worked for Hitler.
Why didn't anybody stop to ask the moral question? At that point, no one could hide anymore from the secrets of Auschwitz. The concentration camps and what happened in them were writ large over Europe. People understood the horrors of what the Nazis had done. How could we then turn around and protect the very people who were responsible for the deaths and murders of 6 million Jews and millions of non-Jews? By uncovering the secrets of 60 years ago, we can come up with some of the same problems and issues that we confront today, and hopefully it will allow us to make wiser decisions.
The CIA really came into its own during the 1950s. The threat of atomic weapons meant that neither the West nor the Soviets wanted to risk an all-out war. So instead, we had the Cold War, where trickery, treachery, and secrecy were the weapons of choice.
By 1958, with communist paranoia at fever pitch, the CIA became convinced that the Russians had a new and powerful secret weapon. The CIA believed that the Russians knew how to control people's minds. The CIA turned to its scientists and asked them to find a drug which could be used to control people's minds. And in 1958, the CIA started a secret drug testing program under the catchy but meaningless name of MK-Ultra.
All right, let's see what we can see.
MK-Ultra was an attempt by the CIA to harness the power of the mind using whatever they could. It was mainly LSD, sound, sensory deprivation. They even tried clairvoyancy and psychic stuff. It was basically mind warfare is the new great battlefield of the Cold War, and we have to do whatever it takes to win this.
Oh, this is very enticing. I mean, the idea that you could give somebody an injection who had been a member of the KGB, for instance, in the Soviet Union, and he or she would immediately spill out everything they knew about the KGB's operations was just terribly enticing.
His motor coordination was disrupted because of the compound's effect. I got the poison, I got the remedy, I got the
poison, the remedy, I got the poison. LSD, PCP, uppers, downers, amphetamines, heroin, and mescaline. You name it, the CIA tried it, all in the name of scientific research.
They set up this brothel in New York, and the customers would have their drinks spiked with LSD. They took over a mental hospital in Montreal, and with the idea of trying to brainwash the mental patients. So they'd give them drugs and play them these noises over and over again.
The behavioral side of the research virtually kidnapped nearly 100 patients and subjected them to heavy doses of LSD, regular electrical shocks, and a football helmet clamped to the head, playing degrading messages up to 500,000 times, such as, "My mother hates me."
God, no! The CIA think that they have a mandate to journey to the furthest corners of their imagination to try stuff out. We have the right to surround a bunch of people and treat them as if they were guinea pigs in the middle of an experimental lab.
Although they are clearly bewildered and perplexed by what is going on inside their heads, they accept this without any particular outward show of distress.
They lost their moral compass and turned into these experimenters. It turned in on itself and became dark.
It came to my attention early in my tenure as director, and I felt it was a warning sign that if you're not alert, things can go wrong in this organization, as they did with MK-Ultra.
But after all those years of testing, the CIA discovered that the drugs didn't control people's minds. They just blew them.
They discovered through all this research that it didn't work. None of the drugs worked. They could confuse people, addle people, get them to babble. But in terms of interrogating them and getting reliable information, it didn't work.
I can't remember a thing. I can't remember. Come on, man. I don't want this stuff.
So for the CIA, the drugs didn't work. But some of the techniques developed in the MKUltra years are still used today.
MKUltra wasn't torture, but the way it lives on is in interrogation techniques in Guantanamo and Iraq. That's when you see MKUltra springing back into life.
In 2006, when you talk about invading a country to get your hands on their oil, you immediately think of Iraq and Saddam Hussein. But the current situation in Iraq isn't the first time the West has interfered in the Middle East over oil. Surprise, surprise. In 1953, in fact, the CIA secretly sponsored its first full-scale coup in Iran. And as a result, the USA kept control of one of the largest oil producers in the world.
Iran was important for two reasons. It had oil and it had a 1,000-mile border with the Soviet Union, now Russia. The CIA wanted access to the border so they could spy on the Soviets and they could put their missiles there. The British, who were deeply involved in this intelligence coup in Iran, we wanted access to Iranian oil. So between us, we quite deliberately and viciously overthrew the Prime Minister, Mr. Mossadegh.
In 1951, Prime Minister Mossadegh became Iran's first democratically elected leader. His first act in power was to nationalize Iran's oil industry, and his second was to begin talks with Iran's Soviet neighbors. Talking to the Soviets and taking back the oil industry might have been popular with the Iranians, but it certainly wasn't popular with the CIA.
What the British and the Americans managed to get terribly wrong was that they thought that Mossadegh was a communist, and that's why they were so fearful about him. They thought that somebody else could come in through the back door into Iran and take over.
Today, the greatest threat to peace is the expansionist aims of the Kremlin. Freedom everywhere, our freedom, is in jeopardy.
In April 1953, Alan Dulles, the CIA director, secretly set aside $1 million to get rid of Mossadegh by any means possible.
The CIA did what it's always done very well. It bought newspapers, it bought periodicals, it bought army officers, it bought intelligence. It just dished out a great deal of money. The CIA has never been short of money, and they spent millions of dollars in Iran to bring about a coup. They organized renter mobs to go through the street shouting against Mossadegh and so on. They pumped up the opposition, and together with the British, they made it work.
Now it was the army and the royalists who'd taken control, and an attack on Mossadegh's home was later followed by his arrest.
2 weeks later, on the 19th of April 1953, Mohammad Mossadegh was overthrown by a mob paid by the CIA and loyal to the Shah. The CIA had successfully overthrown its first government. The Prime Minister was removed and replaced by the Shah of Iran, who ruled the country for the next 25 years. But unleashing the all-powerful Shah on the Iranian people had consequences the CIA had not even considered.
After the coup, Iran became a kind of American base, and the Shah just became an American puppet. And all disaffection, all opposition, all nationalism, all neutralism was simply crushed.
It's quite incredible. Almost a whole army dedicated to educating people. It's all very military, but it gets results.
What actually happened at that stage was that one motive force took over, and that force was Islam. People realized the power of the mosque. They re-realized the power of the mosque. And that's something that we're still trying to come to terms with in the West.
Coming up after the break, we'll reveal more secrets of the CIA, like what happened when the CIA got mixed up with UFOs and the secret operation that went dramatically wrong. All in Secrets of the CIA.
The CIA, of course, came up with a plan. They came up with a bad plan.
There is no question that the CIA knew the order of theft. Of course they knew.
They had an operation which became known as a perfect failure.
Welcome back to Secrets of the CIA. My name's Danny Wallace, and over the next couple of hours, we're going to be revealing more of the CIA's most classified operations. The CIA was set up to protect the West from communism, but in doing so, it had employed Nazis in Europe, experimented with drugs in America, and overthrown democratically elected leaders in the Middle East. The next stop on this secret world tour of mayhem was Africa. The CIA's main concern in Africa was to prevent the Soviets from gaining any sort of stronghold in the continent, and efforts were focused on one huge country at the heart of the region, the Congo.
Within days of formal independence, Congo was in complete turmoil. Patrice Lumumba, who was the prime minister at that stage, was asking the Soviets to help. There were hundreds of Soviet advisers flying into the airport and who were then broadcasting propaganda to the Congolese army.
Lumumba's behaviour was completely unacceptable to the CIA. So the agents in the Congo began to look for a replacement, and they found one in a young man called Mobutu.
CIA first spotted Mobutu as a potential collaborator in 1960. They regarded him as very intelligent, very immature, but very promising.
A new chapter begins in the dark and tragic history of the Congo with the return to Leopoldville of deposed Premier Lumumba, following his capture by crack commandos of strongman Colonel Mobutu.
On January 17, 1961, Lumumba was dragged into the jungle, beaten, and then murdered by troops loyal to Mobutu. The CIA had got its way. Their man Mobutu was now in charge of the Congo, and the Soviets were no longer welcome there.
He was a very helpful, earnest, clever, non-ideological young man from very humble, rather complicated background, who Western people found very useful.
He was very much indeed a strong man, a strong personality, and Congo became his backyard. He had everything for himself. He controlled everything himself. And thus he became, even at the time, even the most richest guy on earth.
Over his lifetime, he was reckoned to have taken $4 billion, equivalent to half of the Congo's GDP. And what did he spend it on? Lots of quote-unquote palaces, which included a whole compound in Gbadolite. It looked like Disney, but it cost a great deal of money. Mobutu had a small airport, but not so small that Concorde couldn't regularly land and take off there, because Concorde was hired for shopping trips to Paris. There is no question that the CIA knew the order of theft. Of course they knew.
Mobutu's greed was matched only by his cruelty, and it was the people of the Congo who paid the high price during his 32 years in power.
He became like an animal. He became like a lion.
Je m'appelle Mobutu.
People were very scared about Mobutu. If you touch Mobutu's politics or Mobutu's interests, you are finished man. You are gone.
I think if you look back, what becomes harder and harder to defend is the fact that the CIA kept supporting Mobutu until the 90s. I find that astonishing. Today, Congo is a source of tremendous instability. It's had a civil war, that has led to 3.7 million deaths. It is one of the most unstable, poorest and most anarchic countries in Africa. I've now spent 10 years in Africa, and every African I've ever met believes that if something happens in his country that is negative and damaging, the CIA was behind it. But they have good reason to think that, because the CIA did intervene time and time again. It did make sure that dictators ended up running the show. It did make sure that human rights atrocities were hushed up. So the paranoia that is still there, which makes every African you meet think that the CIA is probably behind that, is completely justified.
Disinformation, fake leaks and double agents are all a key part of being a spook. I don't need to tell you that. And in the CIA, the job of deciding who's telling the truth and who's lying falls to one of the most suspicious and secretive departments in the CIA, counterintelligence.
In 1952, this department was run by James Jesus Angleton. He trusted no one.
Scientists, diplomats, dissident groups, tourists, the French, students, the CIA, all playing the same theme.
Angleton was convinced every defector from the East who gave the CIA information was actually a double agent planted by the KGB. So he either ignored them or had them locked up. So the CIA had a problem. No information from people on the ground in Russia. Their solution was revolutionary and high-tech. They invented the spy plane, and by mistake, they invented the UFO at the same time.
The United States and the Soviet Union were absolutely paranoid about each other's nuclear capabilities. The Soviet bomber fleet and the Soviet ICBM inventory was of particular interest to the United States because it really didn't have any information about them. And that's why it needed spy planes in particular to go over those sites, take photography, capture imagery, and take that information back to the US. A spy plane needs to be subtly different from any other kind of aircraft. It needs to be able to fly often at great heights to overcome the defenses beneath it. It needs to fly at great ranges. And these two attributes led to inventors of the day really pushing the envelope in terms of what an aeroplane could do. That really tested the Lockheed Skunk Works, which was this special secret entity that was set up to create secret programs like this.
This new technology had to be kept top secret if it was going to be successful. Something that's huge, metal, and flies in the sky is fairly difficult to keep secret, so the CIA used a convenient excuse. When Americans spotted these planes flying over their houses, the CIA encouraged them to believe they'd actually seen a UFO.
We have received and analyzed between 1,000 and 2,000 reports. However, there have been a certain percentage of this volume of reports that have been made by credible observers of relatively incredible things.
The CIA didn't like awkward questions being asked of these kind of high-flying aircraft. And in fact, we have evidence today that it had encouraged UFO stories as a kind of a veil behind which it could hide some of this spy plane technology.
So we've seen how far the CIA is willing to go to prevent the spread of evil communism in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa, employing Nazis, overthrowing leaders, and persuading the world to believe in little green men. So how much further are they prepared to go when the threat is that much nearer to home? Well, on April 17th, 1961, the people of Cuba found out when they came under attack from a full-scale paramilitary assault by the CIA. And it started here, in the Bay of